Hello, and welcome to Words on Film, the spoken word podcast dedicated to moving pictures. I'm Dan Burke, your host and movie critic, and I'm here to tell you exactly what I think of some of the latest movies out right now. For this show, I have three brand new movies to review for you. Actually, two that are brand new, i.e. they came out on Netflix this past week, and one that's been out for a couple of months. The third one is not technically new, but it's new to me, and it's probably brand new to all of you out there listening to the show as well. So, the first movie I'm going to be reviewing for you is one called Animal Crackers, which, despite actually coming out on Netflix on July 24th, it actually, according to IMDb, was made in 2017. And it's a cute story, which is animated, by the way, and not to be confused with the classic 1934 film by the Marx Brothers, which is one of their best films. But Animal Crackers is no relation to the Marx Brothers, and it's about something entirely different. It's about a family who works at a circus who must use a magical box of animal crackers to save their rundown circus from being taken over by their evil uncle, Horatio P. Huntington. This movie begins in 1962, actually, when we're introduced to Horatio P. Huntington, who is very similar to P.T. Barnum in that he's a big-time showman and has a pretty good introductory song. He also, because it's the early 60s, has this look to him that's kind of reminiscent of late Elvis or Engelbert Humperdinck. And I thought that was actually a good look for him. And he's voiced by Sir Ian McKellen, interestingly enough. I'm not sure if the character necessarily matches the voice, but Ian McKellen does a good job in this movie playing a person who is ultimately a villain. And the movie is kind of off to a slow start when we realize that this movie is eventually making its way up to present day. You learn about the father of the character Owen, who's voiced by John Krasinski. This father of Owen works at the circus alongside his brother Horatio. And unlike Horatio, Owen's father, his name is Buffalo Bob, works behind the scenes of this circus, which is in the 60s particularly popular. And he ultimately meets a woman I presume is from Italy by the name of Talia, who's voiced by legendary voice actress Tara Strong. And there's this whole story in the first third of the movie where it details the love triangle between Talia, Buffalo Bob, and his brother Horatio. Horatio wants Talia to himself and is reminiscent of Gaston from Beauty and the Beast, and very similar to Gaston from Beauty and the Beast, when he doesn't get his way, he begins to grow more and more evil, despite his charms. And I think the movie focused a little bit too much on this love triangle, to the point where by the second third of this movie, it focuses on Owen growing up in the circus. Owen, again, is voiced by John Krasinski. And he eventually falls in love with and marries a woman by the name of Zoe, who's played by Emily Blunt. And despite the fact that Emily Blunt is British, she does Zoe in an American accent, which I find to be particularly interesting. It's not unusual for British or Australian actors to don American accents to play an American character. But I always wondered why British or Australian actors put on American accents to voice cartoon characters. Not that there's anything particularly wrong with it, but it's hard enough to voice a cartoon character. I just wonder how much more effort it would take for somebody who's not from America and doesn't have an American accent to voice someone who's American. But either way, the other interesting thing about Emily Blunt's character in this film is Emily Blunt is by far the biggest star in this film, yet she kind of plays second fiddle to John Krasinski's character. And I found that particularly interesting as well. It doesn't take away from my enjoyment of the film. What does take away from my enjoyment of the film is the way the plot is set up. It really should have established Owen and Zoe in the very beginning. I think they could have spent maybe a maximum of 5 minutes clarifying that Owen grew up in the circus and his father played second fiddle to his uncle, Horatio. But it really took a long time to get this going. But the story really begins when Owen reluctantly leaves the circus and ends up working for his father-in-law, who's voiced by Wallace Shawn. And this movie is filled with actors who have done cartoon character voices before. Sir Ian McKellen did a few cartoon voices previously. Danny DeVito, who plays a clown by the name of Chesterfield, who narrates the film, has done several voiovers. I think this might be John Krasinski's first time. Emily Blunt has done voices of cartoon characters in the My Little Pony movie, and she also guest starred one time on The Simpsons as Lisa's new best friend. You also have Sylvester Stallone, interestingly enough, playing an aging stuntman by the name of Bullet Man. And you can instantly tell when Bullet Man starts speaking that it's unquestionably Sylvester Stallone. You also have Patrick Warburton, who's probably best known to people who don't particularly pay attention to names in films, as the character, the recurring character Putty in Seinfeld. But since then, he's done several other movies and TV shows. And he's also done a lot of cartoon character voices. So for him to appear in this movie is, I wouldn't exactly say cliche, but he just kind of plays a character that we've seen him play in several other movies like The Emperor's New Groove and Happily Never After before. But anyway, I think it is kind of cool that this movie is filled with a lot of celebrity voice characters. It is kind of mysterious to me that these actors would be in this movie because it's not particularly original. Actually, it doesn't start off as original. It really gets going and it really becomes more and more enjoyable in the last third of the film when the character Owen is changing from animal avatar to animal avatar simply by eating an animal cracker. I thought that was a very novel idea, and I do think that the movie really takes off and actually has a really good climax by the last third of the movie when the character of Horatio P. Huntington, the P.T. Barnum character, begins to become more evil and also realizes the power of this box of animal crackers, which never runs out, by the way. There's really no explanation as to how this box of animal crackers has its magic, but maybe that could be in another film. But again, Animal Crackers is a film that I think kids are going to like, and I was watching it throughout, and for the first two-thirds of the film, I wasn't really sure whether I liked it or not. It has decent animation for a film that was not made by Disney or DreamWorks or any of the major animation companies, but I do think that the animation really comes alive, and the story really gets going in the last third of the film. Before that, it seems like a lot of buildup, and I don't think that it was particularly necessary for it to be that way. However, I do credit this film, Animal Crackers, for not getting into pop culture references and not trying to be particularly cool like other bigger budget animated films that aren't made by Disney try to be. But I still think the story really needed a lot of work, and also it would have helped if it had gotten some other actors in the film who may not have been particularly familiar to animation audiences. But again, the casting of this film doesn't take away from me, it's the story. But Animal Crackers, for me, gets my rating of a checkout. I do think it is very well animated for an independent movie of its kind. I do think that, especially when the characters start turning into animals, when they start eating the animal crackers, I think that was a good, not only story arc, but also it looked very well animated. And I just think the story in particular needed a lot of work, a lot better pacing. But I do think kids are going to enjoy it. And I think at the end of the day, that's really all that matters. back to Words on Film, the spoken word show dedicated to moving pictures. I am your host and movie critic, Dan Burke. The next movie I'm going to be reviewing for you is a documentary called Father, Soldier, Son. It is also a Netflix original that debuted on July 17th, 2020. And it is a film that is longitudinal. What do I mean by that? What I mean is it was filmed over a period of 10 years and was also done in collaboration with Netflix and the New York Times. If you think the New York Times is just a newspaper, it might have been about 20 years ago, but now the New York Times is actually getting into documentary filmmaking, and you can actually see a lot of documentary films, mini films that the New York Times has done, which are on YouTube right now, and you can watch them absolutely free. And it is actually pretty amazing, not only the film quality of the New York Times when they make these documentaries, but also the fact that they make really smart documentaries. And I think it's only a matter of time before a film that was produced or co-produced by the New York Times gets nominated for an Oscar for Best Documentary. I'm not saying it's going to happen this year, but it could happen in the next 5 to 10 years. But Father, Soldier, Son is a documentary that details the life of U.S. Army Sergeant First Class Brian Eich, who we meet originally in 2010 when he is still a Sergeant First Class on active duty in Afghanistan. And he is a single father of two sons, Isaac, who we meet at the age of 12, and Joey, who we originally meet at the age of 7. And when he is away on deployment in Afghanistan for 6 months, the boys live with their uncle, and like the children of many military families, they long to have their father back home. They do get their wish, but it's when Brian Eich is injured in the line of duty and is honorably discharged. So the movie begins to look at the Eich family over the course of literally 10 years. We see Isaac and Joey Eich grow up right before our eyes. And we also see Brian Eich struggling to adapt to civilian life. We don't see necessarily his struggles with post-traumatic stress disorder, but probably when the cameras were turned off, like, for instance, when he's sleeping at night, he probably has struggled with that and may even still struggle with it. But the movie focuses less on PTSD and more about the struggles of Brian Eich to connect with his sons after being away for so long, and also mainly to adapt to civilian life after being honorably discharged. And it also details his health problems. For instance, when he was last in Afghanistan, his leg got injured, and he chose to keep his leg initially because it was his leg. But then, eventually, 4 years later, he finds that he is in way too much pain walking on that leg, and he's also taking medication that causes him to gain weight. And because of that, he makes the reluctant decision to lose his leg. And even though he's in less pain, he still struggles with that. So he's struggling with a lot. And I think that this movie, this documentary, is not detailing something that is uncommon, particularly amongst military families. And there's always that struggle, even when a father or sometimes even a mother is in the armed services and have to be deployed. They may not necessarily be going to war, but they are leaving behind their immediate family for a prolonged period of time. There's a lot of struggle with that. There's struggles with the parents, there's struggles with the children, and it's all understandable. I didn't grow up in a military family, but I know several people who did. I have one best friend from high school, for instance, who has a father who was, and maybe still is, a merchant marine. And he even struggled with his father being away for 6 to 9 months at a time, only coming back for maybe about a month or two. He's still taking care of the family monetarily, but he's not there in the house. And I don't know firsthand what that struggle is like, but I could certainly empathize. And especially for families who have parents who are actually fighting overseas, most especially in the Afghanistan war, which is the longest running American war to date. It surpassed the Vietnam War for the longest American war a few years ago. And unfortunately, Al-Qaeda is still a threat, even though Osama bin Laden and several other high-ranking Al-Qaeda officials, soldiers, I should say, have been killed. They're still a threat. Terrorism still looms large in Afghanistan and a lot of the Middle East. And unfortunately, American soldiers are still there with no conceivable way out, especially, dare I say it, with the president we have right now. And also, I think maybe, just maybe, the upside to the pandemic, if there's any upside, is that the fighting has stopped. But somehow I doubt that's true. So I don't know that as a fact. But one thing I do know is that Father Soldier Son is an excellent documentary. And it is heart-wrenching in certain areas. In fact, there's one particular part, and this happens pretty much, let me just say this. All of this is true. There's no exaggeration to this. And of course you might say, it's a documentary, of course it's true, but sometimes documentaries can exaggerate. But all of this did happen. There's one particularly shocking moment where one of the people in this documentary we get to know from the beginning dies. I'm not going to tell you who it is because Words on Film has a no spoiler rule, and this certainly will be no exception. But that's probably one of the most heart-wrenching scenes in this movie. It's also very heartbreaking when, in the beginning of the film, you have Brian Eich going off to fight in Afghanistan, and he's leaving his kids behind. And especially the way Isaac, his oldest son, handles this is really sad. But it is a part of life for military families, especially when we still have a war going on. So Father Soldier Son is an amazing documentary. It's produced and directed by Katrin Einhorn and Leslie Davis. I haven't seen any other documentaries that those two have done before, but if it's anything like this documentary, then I would definitely be willing to see what other movies they have directed. But Father Soldier Son is a knockout. It is amazing how much footage they were able to get. It's also amazing that they were able to film this family over the course of a decade. That doesn't happen. It's happened with some documentaries. Many documentaries are filmed over a particular period, but I don't think there's one documentary that's been filmed continuously and recurringly over the course of 10 years. At least there aren't many documentaries like that. There are documentaries that film one particular year, and then they come, like for instance, there's one documentary that's called Seven Up, which details the life of these kids when they're at the age of seven. And then the filmmakers came back 7 years later to film 14 Up, which detailed the same kids at the age of 14. And then they had 21 Up, 28 Up. I haven't seen these documentaries, but I know of them. I think they made it up to 35, maybe even higher, but it is quite amazing, longitudinal documentaries. But this is one film that's filmed over the course of a decade. It's amazing how they were able to film it for this long. It's amazing some of the shots they got without anybody in the family looking at the camera. And this film has a lot of hard parts to watch, hard parts to sit through, but it is a well-made documentary and unquestionably the best documentary I've seen so far this year. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Words on Film, the spoken word show dedicated to moving pictures. I am your host and movie critic, Dan Burke. The next movie I'm going to be reviewing for you is Mucho, Mucho Amor, The Legend of Walter Mercado. This is a 2020 documentary that debuted on Netflix on July 8th of this year. It's directed by Christina Costantini and Karim Tapsch and features interviews with Walter Mercado, who actually died on November 2nd of last year. He died at the age of 87. And Walter Mercado, for those people who don't know, was born Walter Mercado Salinas on March 9th, 1932 in Ponce, Puerto Rico. Forgive me if I pronounce that, the name of that town incorrectly, but Walter Mercado was a very flamboyant and effeminate astrologer who had a show on cable where he basically foretold people's fortunes based on their astrological sign. So I have never seen Walter Mercado on TV in my life. It may be partly because I'm not Latino. It may also be because I didn't get cable until much later in my life. But if you talk to most people in the Latin American community, they know exactly who Walter Mercado is. And I think especially after Walter Mercado's death, he has developed a cult following amongst people of Latino and Puerto Rican, especially Puerto Rican descent. In fact, Lin-Manuel Miranda, the creator and star of Hamilton, is a huge fan of Walter Mercado and actually appears in this film after he's had so much success with Hamilton just to meet Walter Mercado in person. It's a really sweet moment. The reason I didn't get entirely into this documentary is because I was kind of mystified by Walter Mercado. I didn't quite understand his appeal so much, but then again, I also don't understand the appeal of Richard Simmons. And Walter Mercado has a lot in common with Richard Simmons. They both appeared on TV and made a name for themselves in the 1980s. It's surprising how big a name they had for themselves. They're both unabashedly flamboyant. They both have a lot of people assuming that they're gay based on their flamboyance and their brand and their lifestyle. But the interesting thing about both of them is that they both never disclosed their sexual identity. A lot of people assume that Richard Simmons is gay, but the truth of the matter is, A, he's never officially come out of the closet, and B, he lives alone with his two dogs. Walter Mercado also, until the end of his life, lived mainly alone with the exception of help from a personal assistant who was actually interviewed in this film. And it is interesting to see the parts of this documentary where people like Lin-Manuel Miranda and Eugenio Derbez talk glowingly about Walter Mercado. These are both straight men, by the way, as far as I know. But Eugenio Derbez first made a name for himself in Mexico as a comedian who actually went on TV and impersonated Walter Mercado, similar to the way that SNL has impersonated Richard Simmons and Liberace and other equally flamboyant celebrities who are better known to English-speaking audiences. And in Eugenio Derbez's impersonation, as well as others, there was certainly a bit of homophobia to that performance. And Eugenio Derbez never admitted it, but other people in the documentary did. And they said that Latinx culture has always been virulently homophobic. Even gay people who are Latino, who are interviewed in this film, make that claim. And it is too bad, but it's certainly not the only background who is homophobic. Although homophobia has in my opinion, been taken a lot more seriously in recent years, and a lot of people have shied away from it, which I think is a very good sign for humanity in general. But that doesn't necessarily mean that I would get into Walter Mercado and his image and his message. But I think watching this documentary made me certainly appreciate people like Lin-Manuel Miranda, who looked up to Walter Mercado and saw him as inspiring. In fact, I even liked when Lin-Manuel Miranda was interviewed and he said, in English, by the way, sometimes he speaks Spanish, sometimes he speaks English in this film, but when he was watching TV with his family, the channels that were Spanish-speaking, like Univision, would be Gossip Show, Gossip Show, Gossip Show, Gossip Show, and then Walter Mercado Show, and he goes, "Everybody be quiet, Walter Mercado is on." I thought that was cool. There's certainly a few shows that it was kind of like that in my family, where everybody come downstairs, this show's on. I'm not going to say what those shows are, because I don't want to embarrass any members of my family, but, you know, I certainly have nostalgic feelings about certain TV programs like that. And I think that Walter Mercado is having that sort of popular resurgence the same way that Julia Child, Fred Rogers, and Bob Ross are today. All three personalities are deceased, but all three of them had their own low-key, low-budget public television shows that aired in the background of many people's lives. And that's actually doing a bit of disservice to Fred Rogers by saying that he aired in the background. That's not true at all. When his show was on from 1968 to 2001, a lot of kids, generations of children, including me, tuned into it and had our and gave the show our undivided attention. But other shows that were a little slow-paced, like Julia Child and Bob Ross, certainly played in the background of a lot of our time growing up. But now that those personalities are gone, and especially thanks to YouTube, a lot of people uploading these episodes from their low quality videotapes and putting it on digital, that's created a resurgence of popularity amongst these personalities. And I think Walter Mercado can easily be lumped in with those other personalities. With that said, I didn't especially love the documentary. I certainly came out of it having an appreciation for Walter Mercado. And maybe if I was Latinx myself, I might have a love for his show. But the movie didn't really make me want to seek out Walter Mercado's show and didn't really touch on what exactly he was saying that was inspiring to people. Was it his horoscopes that gave people hope? Was it the fact that he was being flamboyant and being himself to a large exaggerated extent that gave people hope? I don't know, and I guess you could extrapolate that from the movie, but even with the interviews, particularly with Lin-Manuel Miranda, which emphasized how much of a personality he was to an international audience, and even some people in America, I got that, but I just didn't really get why exactly he was inspiring. And that's really what I needed to take from this movie. But I did think that Walter Mercado was a fascinating subject nonetheless. And I did like even some of the more dull aspects of the film, like when he's getting himself breakfast and his personal assistant is making sure he gets the vitamins he needs. The vitamins must have worked because he died at the age of 87. So, and he looked pretty good, all things considered, for an 87-year-old when he died. But, you know, I think I wanted more from this documentary, and just like I mentioned. So, mucho, mucho amor, which means a lot of love for those people who don't speak Spanish, was Walter Mercado's sign-off for his show. The movie Mucho Mucho Amor, The Legend of Walter Mercado, is a checkout in my book. I think I came out of it having an appreciation for some of those early cable TV stars, and particularly those who weren't directed towards a mainstream audience, but developed more of a cult personality, including amongst some English speakers, just by being themselves. I really appreciated that coming out of the film. I think the narrative could have used a little bit of work, as well as maybe more emphasis on why exactly Walter Mercado was as inspirational to a lot of Latinx people as he was. But I still appreciated the movie for what it was. I do think it's a fun documentary to watch. And even if you have never heard of Walter Mercado in your life, this movie will undoubtedly make you appreciate him even more. And if that's what the movie does, then all the power to it. Welcome back to Words on Film, the spoken word show dedicated to moving pictures. I am your host and movie critic, Dan Burke. I have reviewed all the films that I have to review for you for this show, so it's now time for me to get into a topic of movies that are either coming up next, particularly on Netflix this coming week, the week of July 26th through August 1st. And I'm also going to give you a little bit of background on movies that are actually leaving Netflix, because that is also very important to know. I know for me personally, I've been in situations where I got 30 minutes into a movie on Netflix, a movie that was not a Netflix original, because I think Netflix originals basically stay on Netflix streaming forever. But I'm 30 minutes into a movie, and then I have something else to do. I say I'll get back to it. And by the time I have time to get back to it, it's left Netflix. That happened in 2018 when Love Actually was on Netflix. A little while before Christmas, I watched 30 minutes of the film. Then I had a lot of Christmas preparation to do. And then by the time I got back to the film, it was January, only to find that it had been completely removed from my Netflix watch list. And it goes without saying that that really infuriated me. Now, I could subscribe to DVD.com, which is the segment of Netflix that, of course, allows you to do what Netflix was founded on doing, which is rent DVDs, but I have not signed up for that service for quite some time. And I don't think I'm alone in that aspect, but there are some advantages and disadvantages to renting the DVD as opposed to streaming. One of the biggest disadvantages of renting DVDs is that DVDs can sometimes skip. They are very easy to damage. One scratch on those and basically you're screwed. But in any event, here's what's coming up on Netflix this coming week, the week of July 26th through August 1st. There is a movie that is debuting on Netflix on July 26th, which is Sunday, which is called Banana Split. This is a foreign film, but Banana Split is a movie directed by Benjamin Kosulke. He directed one movie called Safety Not Guaranteed, which I have heard of. The movie Banana Split is a movie that takes place over the course of a summer, which is great for debuting on Netflix, but two teenage girls develop the perfect kindred spirit friendship with one big problem. One of them is dating the other's ex. That sounds very juicy. The movie stars Hannah Marks, Liana Liberato, and Dylan Sprouse, And two out of three of those actors I know are American, so maybe I was mistaken on Banana Split being a foreign film, but I'd be interested to see that film. I mean, of course, teenage love triangles aren't exactly my thing because I'm not a teenager. Banana Split is debuting on Sunday, July 26th. I'll try to see that movie. I won't guarantee that I'll be reviewing it for you for the next show, but I will tell you that I will look out for it for sure. There is one film that's a Netflix original that's debuting on Wednesday, July 29th, and it's called The Hater. The Hater is a foreign film. This one I know is foreign because it's directed by Jan Komasa, who is Polish. It's about a young man who searches for purpose in a net of hatred and violence that he tries to control. It sounds very vague. The movie is debuting on July 29th in the United States. It is a 2020 film, so I don't think that it debuted in theaters at any time in Poland, but I could be wrong. Because it's a Netflix original, I will definitely see that film, and I will let you know what I think on next week's show. A movie that is appearing on Netflix, but is not a Netflix original, is the movie Pirates Who Don't Do Anything, a VeggieTales movie. I could tell you right off the bat, this is a movie I will not be seeing. One, because it's not brand new, it's been out for a few years. And two, because it is a VeggieTales movie. Truth be told, VeggieTales scare me. They really do. I don't know if it's the animation, it's the preachiness, it's a lot of things. And maybe it's just fearing the unknown for me, but VeggieTales is one of those properties that is very popular amongst kids, particularly Christian children. I would love to know if any Jewish children watch a VeggieTales movie, but then again, VeggieTales do depict biblical stories from the Old Testament, so maybe Jewish kids are into it, but I doubt it. Some Jewish kids, I don't know. But Pirates Who Don't Do Anything, I don't really know what connection that is to Pirates of the Caribbean. I don't think any of the Pirates of the Caribbean movies are named Pirates Who Do Something. I don't know. So I don't really get a VeggieTales movie, but if you're interested, it will be on Netflix on Thursday, July 30th. Friday, July 31st, there are several series that are going to be premiering on Netflix. In fact, the movies that are debuting on Netflix on Friday, July 31st, debuting streaming, I might add, are all Netflix originals. I am going to discriminate from the series that are premiering on Netflix and go right to the movies. One of the movies is called Latte and the Magic Waterstone, which sounds like a fascinating title. Latte and the Magic Waterstone is actually an animated film. Okay, this is interesting. It's a CGI animated movie, and it follows the journey of a young hedgehog who wants to save the forest and its inhabitants from a horrible drought by reclaiming a magical waterstone from the Bear King. This movie is directed by Mimi Maynard and Paulette Victor Lifton. It's an entirely original film. And the cast members of the movie are actors with whom I'm not familiar. The voice actors include Timur Bartels, Henning Baum, Leslie L. Miller, Byron Mark Newsom, Gunnar Sizemore, and the list goes on. I've never heard of these actors, but I will see Latte and the Magic Waterstone, partly because I'm curious what a waterstone looks like, but I will let you know what I think on next week's show. Another film that is premiering on Netflix is one that's called Seriously Single, which sounds like a romantic comedy. This movie is also a Netflix original. The lead actress is named Fulu Magovani. That sounds like an Italian name. But the movie, Seriously Single, it tells the story of Dineo, who is the definition of a serial monogamist. I've never heard that term before. She dates to fall in love. She falls in love to get married, okay? But she never gets married. She always ends up being dumped. Okay, this movie is obviously a romantic comedy, but I'm on board here because you don't hear about serial monogamists all that much. But when she meets Lunga Sibiya, He seems to be the man she's waited for her whole life. A man who shares her values when it comes to love and relationships. Or so she thinks. There's more to this synopsis, but I'm going to end it right there. But Seriously Single is a unique premise for a romantic comedy, and it has a predominantly black cast. So Seriously Single is not exactly my kind of movie, but I will check it out, and I will let you know what I think on next week's show. Another movie that's coming out on Friday, July 31st, is one called The Speed Cubers. This is a documentary. IMDb is telling me absolutely nothing about it, so I wish I had more information for you about this documentary, The Speed Cubers. I don't know what a cuber is, let alone a speed cuber, so I have no idea. I can't even speculate what this documentary involves. But I will tell you that there are other shows that are premiering on Netflix. I won't get into what the details are because this is words on film, not words on TV shows. There is a series premiere of a show called Get Even. Sounds kind of interesting. There's also a season 3 premiere of Sugar Rush. They're a series I have not seen. There's also the second season of Umbrella Academy that is premiering on Netflix on Friday, July 31st. And there's also a Netflix original, which is called Via V, El Oasis, known by its parenthesized name as Locked Up. There are a handful of films that are premiering on Netflix on July 31st. I mentioned them briefly. Latte and the Magic Waterstone is a film that is animated. Seriously Single is a live-action romantic comedy. And The Speed Cubers is a documentary. So I will check these movies out and I will let you know what I think on next week's show. Welcome back to Words on Film, the spoken word show dedicated to moving pictures. I'm your host and movie critic, Dan Burke. And now that I've told you what's coming out on Netflix, let me tell you what is leaving Netflix streaming this coming Friday, July 31st. The Back to the Future movies, all three of them, Back to the Futures Part 1, 2, and 3, are currently available for streaming on Netflix. If you want to check these movies out, I highly recommend you do so before Saturday, August 1st, because Friday, July 31st will be the very last day they're going to be featured on Netflix. For me, I had the trilogy on DVD, and I had to actually forfeit that as well as literally hundreds of other DVDs that I had when I moved from Boston to Nashville. But the good news is that I can get the Back to the Future trilogy on Blu-ray and or 4K. I don't have a 4K player or a high definition TV, not yet. I don't have the $3,000 or $4,000 to cough up for a TV of that magnitude. But for some of these movies that are worth seeing in high definition, like the Back to the Future trilogy, I might consider investing in one. But for those of you who have not checked out the Back to the Future trilogy, if you are among the few who have been living under a rock and have not seen it, now's the time to check it out. This week is the time to check it out. Hell, it's great viewing on a Saturday night, especially when you are quarantined or social distancing. It brings you back to a simpler time, that's for sure. And I'm not talking about the 50s, I'm talking about the 80s. The 80s were a seemingly simpler time. I'm not nostalgic for the 80s, but there was a lot less chaos going on in the 80s than there is now. Just saying. There are other films that are leaving Netflix on Friday, July 31st, including Can't Hardly Wait, which is a film that debuted in the summer of 1998 when I was graduating from the 8th grade. Now, the characters in that movie are graduating from high school, and I couldn't exactly relate to the characters there because they were in the suburbs, they came from a huge school, and some of them were stereotypes, but Can't Hardly Wait is a pretty enjoyable film that I keep coming back to again and again. And some of the performances in that film are very funny. But if you want to check it out on Netflix, you only have until through this Friday to check it out. Another film that's leaving Netflix right now is the Casper live-action film, which stars in live-action form Christina Ricci and Bill Pullman. It's a decent film, I thought. I thought there were certainly some sweet moments. Oh, it also co-stars Eric Idle and Kathy Moriarty as some very fun villains. But if you want to check that movie out on Netflix, check it out this week, because otherwise it is leaving Netflix. Another movie that's not a Netflix original and is leaving Netflix at the end of this month is Charlie and the Chocolate Factory. Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, the Tim Burton movie from 2005, which I thought was pretty decent. When Tim Burton directed it, I thought it was great that he stayed true to the source material that is Roald Dahl's original book. There are certainly moments in Charlie and the Chocolate Factory that were more faithful to Roald Dahl than the 1971 original. But the one thing I hated, and I mean hated, about Charlie and the Chocolate Factory was Johnny Depp. Johnny Depp is a good actor, and I've enjoyed him in several movies, but man, he is not funny, especially when he puts on that accent of his where he lisps, and he's overall just very smug and very smarmy. I didn't really get behind his interpretation of Willy Wonka, and I much preferred Gene Wilder's Willy Wonka to his. But other than that, I did actually enjoy the film, and other than Johnny Depp, I thought that Charlie and the Chocolate Factory was very well cast. I especially liked Freddie Highmore as Charlie in the film. I thought he was very sweet, and he did a good job. Other films, wow, a lot of classic ones here. E.T. the Extraterrestrial, that's not going to be on Netflix after this week. We also have Hancock, the Will Smith movie, which got a lot of good press when it was released in the summer of 2008 until The Dark Knight came out and just blew Hancock out of the water. The Dark Knight was a better film. It did overshadow a lot of other comic-themed movies that came out that summer, like Iron Man, The Incredible Hulk. Hancock, I don't think, was based on a comic. It might have been based on a graphic novel, but certainly not a series of comics. But yeah, after The Dark Knight came out, there was just no comparison. But if you take The Dark Knight out of the equation, Hancock is a very good and very original sort of anti-hero movie, and Will Smith actually does a really good job playing someone who is not particularly charismatic. Obviously, we all know from seeing him on TV and in movies that Will Smith is very charismatic, but it takes a really good actor to play someone who's not charismatic, and I think Will Smith is one of the few actors who is able to convincingly pull that off. Plus, I really liked him and Jason Bateman in the film as well. So, check it out. It's on Netflix this week. And after Friday, July 31st, it's going to be taken off Netflix. There are several other films that I could mention, although I am running a bit out of time. Let me mention some films that I have not seen. There's one documentary that's on Netflix right now that I will watch before it's taken off. And I will make it my duty to watch this film. It is Searching for Sugar Man. And Searching for Sugar Man is a documentary that came out about a decade ago. And it is a film that was so popular when it was amongst critics that it was nominated for an Academy Award for Best Documentary Feature. Let me actually look some more. It came out in 2012, was nominated for the Best Documentary Feature at the 2013 Academy Awards. And not only was it nominated, it won. And this is obviously a true story about two South Africans who set out to discover what happened to their unlikely musical hero, the mysterious 1970s rock and roller Rodriguez. And I never knew about Rodriguez until I saw this movie. Rodriguez is an American-born singer whose full name is Sisto Diaz Rodriguez, and he developed a cult following, apparently, when he released a series of records in the 1970s. And it's really cool sometimes how somebody who has a lot of fame, maybe not necessarily fortune, but fame, is able to step away from the spotlight and they leave behind a recorded legacy of their work. I think that's really cool. And it also allows them to develop a following, whether they mean to develop one or not. It's a fascinating story, but unfortunately one I have not seen yet. But this is more of a cautionary warning for me than maybe for some more of you who might not be interested in seeing this documentary. But if you are, Searching for Sugar Man is available on Netflix now. After this Friday, it will not be. So I'm going to check this movie out. I may not necessarily talk about it for next week's show, but who knows? I might be able to do that as well.
Well, that's all the time I have for this episode of Words on Film. I always love talking about movies, and I hope you liked what you heard. If you did, please subscribe and rate the show and leave comments if you can. I would love to get your feedback, even if it's more criticism than praise. This has been Words on Film. I'm Dan Burke, and until my next episode, I'll see you at the movies.